I'd like to, apologize to our Wurzburger for the fact that I didn't realize this is the first day of vacation. I thought it was next week. But, on the one hand, we have less people, but on the other hand, I feel it's a greater opportunity because I always like more of an informal kind of a situation, I think. And I can feel more free, Rabbi Wurzburger. So I really want to thank Rabbi Wurzburger for coming, and what we discussed before was, I mean, we have an opportunity to speak with a great monarch in this door who has a lifetime of experience and who was close to the Rav. And I just feel that it's an opportunity that we have, that you should feel free to ask questions or whatever Rabbi Wurzburger feels would be most appropriate, and in order to avail ourselves of the knowledge that we are fortunate to be able to take advantage of. So without any further introduction, I just want to say that Rabbi Wurzburger was someone that, Chazal talk about the Mus Dyukno, and when I was a youngster in Boston, so Rabbi Wurzburger had a shul, and I must have been about 11, 12, and I always, I wasn't in a position to be a judge, but I always enjoyed Rabbi Wurzburger's drushes, and I used to always go to the shul. So he was someone that for me has a certain kind of an invaluable type of what Chazal called a Dmus Dyukno, someone who in your mind plays a role in your life somehow in guiding you. So that's an additional dimension to my relationship with that Wurzburger. So without any further introduction, I'd like to give you the opportunity to start the session in any way that Rabbi Wurzburger would like to do it. It's up to you.
It's a great honor to be invited by the Rosh Yeshiva, and it would be presumptuous for me to go to give you Torah because I know you have here the Rosh Yeshiva. So I will only speak about things which I know no one else can speak about it because they're personal experiences. And it's not as presumptuous as trying to give you a lecture in front of the Rosh Yeshiva. The Shia's mother has indicated to me would like me to share with you some of my experiences with the Rav. And I believe it is very vital because you always have already in the Gemara the concept of Maserav. What you see a person actually doing is sometimes more impressive and more significant than what a person expounds to you in theory. And as a matter of fact, often I remember a conversation with the Rav, in which the Rav said, the Vrocha said, speaking about certain developments within the Orthodox community, all kinds of new chumras, etc., etc. So the Rav said to me, the trouble nowadays is that people use texts, but they have no tradition. Without the Mesorah, because he was very strongly involved in the culture of Mesorah, that it's important that there is this kind of personal contact. He very often spoke about the Rebbe-Talmud relationship, because he felt the Torah Shabbatah requires personality. You cannot convey it simply in the form of Sforim, books, even printed Shiurim, or even perhaps tapes. Because this no tape, even a videotape, cannot make up for the Rebbe-Talmud relationship. And Mesorah is based upon a Rebbe-Talmud relationship. So therefore, the Rav, I know he invested a tremendous amount of strength in his Talmidim, and to him his life was basically the teaching of Gemara. People asked him, I asked him once in a while, I said, look, in the academic world, which I know a little bit about, the people are anxious to get away from teaching. because then they can write and concentrate on their literary output, etc., etc. And when I was editor of tradition, I resented the fact that Hoff wrote so little, because instead of what I felt would have been a better thing for him to do, spend the summer writing, it was vacation, etc., but he insisted on getting his Talmidim to Boston and give shiurim there. But the Rav indicated that he only lives for giving shiurim. As a matter of fact, there was a conservative somebody worked for the conservative movement, but he used to come to his shiurim in Moria. So the Rav, he once wrote a piece, in, I think it was Congress Weekly, about the experience of the Rav shiurim. So he said that the Rav seems to be a very lonely figure, but the only time when he's not lonely is when he's teaching Torah. So the Rav, the fellow showed me a letter the Rav sent to him and said, "You're right, when I'm teaching, I'm not lonely." And otherwise, it would be a very lonely individual, because they had the loneliness of a person who really had no peer. You sometimes speak about the person being chat bedorah. I said he's not chat bedorah, it's chat bedorah. Because that unique combination of a person who was, at one hand, such a godol b'teira, goyim otzum, at the same time knew the world in such a way that I remember once I was sitting next to the Rav, and at some private gathering, and he asked me to come along, and one of my Dr. Lander, who is now the professor of Touro College, invited a number of professors from NYU, from Columbia, New School of Social Research, etc., to come to hear the Rav. So the Rav asked me to come along with him, so I went with him. I was sitting next to the Rav, and a very famous professor who was a leftist, and had a conversation for about 10 minutes, and after 10 minutes this professor couldn't stop anymore, couldn't contain himself anymore, and he said, "But Rabbi, you shouldn't be a rabbi, you should be a professor." That is, he had such tremendous knowledge of the world, and so therefore to have this combination, can't think of anyone who anyway comes near him in that particular sense in the last few hundred years. So I must confess, the Rav is a very complicated person. That's why you find sometimes so many different versions about what he represented. Because the Rav, on the one hand, was one who respected individuality. The Rav did not want people simply to say the same thing as he did. Often quoted the Gemara, when Reish Lakish was nifta, and then Rav Yochanan was so deeply disturbed, so people said to him, "Look, we can bring you many, many other Talmidim. We can also say Tanya the Messiah." He said, "I don't need a Tanya the Messiah look. I want somebody who objects to me." The Rav did not want what we call today yes men. As a matter of fact, he even explained with respect to marriage, he was to say, the Torah uses the expression, Esa kenegdo. What is Esa kenegdo? And Esa by opposing him. In other words, representing an ant-pole. Not that the woman is supposed to be simply a carbon copy and do exactly what her husband wants, but she has to provide a kind of balance and different perspective. As a matter of fact, he had such confidence in the perspective of women that he called once. I had a personal problem. I lived that time in Toronto, went specially to see him, and at that time I consulted him on a personal matter. After I spoke with him for 10 minutes, he said to me, "Would you mind if you called in Mrs. Soloveitchik? She has the Bino Yesero of a woman." Now, I couldn't believe what I saw, that here I got a Gadol B'Torah, whom I asked for advice, and he says, let's call in my wife for the Bina Yeseva. But that was the Rav, you know. He had this tremendous regard for different perspectives and never wanted to impose upon himself his views on someone else. I remember many, many times I had difficult shilas of community policy, etc., etc., and asked the Rav many times for guidance. And many, many times, not always, but many, many times he said, look, you have to decide this on the spot. You're in the situation, you have to decide. I cannot tell you what to do. You have to wrestle with the problem yourself. The Rav was not the kind of individual who wanted to people just to follow him blindly. As you know, for example, in some yeshivas, the Bocha is not allowed to think for himself. He has to exactly imitate whatever the Rav, whatever the yeshiva says, has to go. The Rav was not that way. As a matter of fact, some people are amazed that there are people who might have different views. The Rav did not in any way object to people having different views. I remember many times when he spoke of philosophical issues, he said, look, that's how I experience it. If it helps you, fine. If you don't want it that way, don't accept it. That's being out about the halacha. But on question of hashkafa, etc., the Rav felt, this is my hashkafa, that's the way I experience it. As a matter of fact, the Rav never felt that you could actually prove anything about the truth of Yahadus. I remember that Meister Shoyer was a personal tragedy for me. When I was in Toronto, I had a young man who came to me with a question. His parents wanted to join him to go to Florida. So what's the problem? He said, but you don't realize. When we drive on Shabbos, and when we check in a motel and I don't order meat, my mother takes a fit. So I said, what's your problem? He said, look, I'm between the fourth and the fifth commandment. On one hand, I have to be keep without aim, and on the other hand, I have the concept of Shabbos and all that. So I took out the Chumash and showed him the Rashi in Kedoshim, this boy gradually became very full, studied Torah, not too much, but a little bit. I invested a lot of effort with him. As my wife used to say, if you put in half the time that you put in with this boy, with your own children, you're doing well. But I felt, say, chelki mikol amoli. This boy was a brilliant student, went to the University of Toronto, and he wrote essays, which prize-winning essays for that time, that Yavnin was a Jewish publication, and he was a wonderful asset. And I felt that he wrote beautifully on religious issues, etc. As a matter of fact, he was so talented. The University of Toronto, which had different standards than the American universities, because they have 5 years of high school and all that, so they usually would not recognize anyone, allow anyone to take a year in American universities. Even if a person would want to go to Harvard for a year, they wouldn't allow it. But he got permission to spend 1 year at Yeshiva University. Now, unfortunately, when he came to Yeshiva University, he came under the influence of at that time, a professor of philosophy. He was not religious. And he came back with all kinds of questions. So I asked him to speak to so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so. He had already spoken to all of them. And he was troubled by theoretical questions about the possibility of having belief in Torah and Shemayim. So in my despair, I called up the Rav. And I figured the Rav would be able to mesmerize him and have an impact upon him. The Rav said to me, what can I do for him? I can't prove to him the truth of Yahadus. I can tell him what Yahadus means. I can help him appreciate Yahadus, but I cannot give any proof for the validity of Yahadus. Maybe come for a Shabbos. That'd be a different story. So it didn't work out because the Rebbe started getting sick, etc. All of a sudden, parts were moving, so it didn't work out. And I must confess, this was one of the major personal tragedies in my rabbinic experience, that this boy who had so much promise became completely non-religious. But also shows you where you cannot predict. When I spent so much time with this boy, he brought along another boy who was from a conservative synagogue, and so I figured, right, he wants to learn with me too. So this, from this boy, we didn't expect much. He was a very mediocre boy. He went to yeshiva, and he got smicha. He still functions as a rov. And we are expected to have great nachas from, had nothing but by kafel asher and novim miyask yushin, and absolutely no satisfaction. From this boy, whom I just reluctantly took along because of the fact that it didn't cost me really any time, because I spent the time anyhow on the other boy. From this, that one, I had terrible disappointment, and this particular boy gave me at least some satisfaction. He wrote for me later on for tradition, etc. It shows you cannot ever predict. I spoke to you about him, the experiences, the personal experience. The Rav always stressed this. And you may have seen in some of his writings also, but he often spoke about the fact that while he can give to people Torah, give them shiurim, but he cannot convey to them the experience which he had in terms of davening, in terms of the kedusha of a yom tov, etc., etc. He said, that is beyond me. I can't do it. And that is so important. And I tell you honestly, I have forgotten a lot of shiurim. You're getting old, you know, you forget things. But I can't forget how he would say, Hallel the Seder. The slavos, the fervor, and the religious intensity. You could see that he was transfixed. I just can't forget the moments when he would say Hallel. I could then appreciate why so often he would tell us, he can't have Minchana after Shir. And I think it's a wonderful preparation. And I'm this power. But he said, I'm too exhausted. And to him, Tfilah was, as Yehuda Levi describes it in the Kusari, it was the Mozan Haguf, a Mozan Neshama, the sustenance, the food for his own Neshama. To him, Tfilah meant so much. Yom Kippur, unbelievable what Yom Kippur meant to him. If you'd ask the Rav what was his greatest Yom Tov, he would not see Simchas Torah. To him, Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur, the day Lifnei Hashem, that was to him the great experience, the high point of his life. I once asked him, he had to get liquid because he was suffering from some medical problems, had to get liquid. So I was told that he, in order to avoid taking liquids, had a goyish nurse, because from a mirror and nochri from choli is mutter. So he asked the goyish nurse to feed, to have intravenous feeding by a goyish nurse, because this is no isa of inuyim, there's no isa of achil or shtir in that, because you get it not there as a chilo. So he did it that way, so in order to avoid drinking Yom Pochas Mekashir on Yom Kippur. So I asked the Rav, was that really necessary? If it's a question of Pikuach Nefesh, Pikuach Nefesh, Techa Akar, why couldn't you drink a little bit on Yom Kippur? Because the doctor said you must have a certain amount of liquids, etc. So Rav said, I know that too. But I couldn't get myself to drink on Yom Kippur. For me, this is the great tragedy, that I should have to violate the Kedusha of Yom Kippur by drinking. That to him was the great tragedy. Now, that is really something that has to do with the religious experience. And nobody could tell me what the religious experience was of the prophets. I laugh because I once came back from a convention, the Union of Orthodox Congregations, with the Lord spoke. And that particular convention, the Lord said, made a statement. We in America have to do more. In Germany also they had academicians who also were shomer mitzvahs. But we need more. We need not only shomer mitzvahs, but we also need academicians who have been eternal. Volunteer. So I come to a rabbinic function, so somebody met some from some other yeshiva, so a few days after, what's happened to Rabbi Soloveitchik? The lady says that's important to be in, to be observant. They completely misunderstood or they distorted what was said. But the love meant you have to also have this additional dimension of lomdas. You need lomdas. You cannot have simply people in the academic world and just are observant. You observe all Tanesim and you are makbid and midat mitzvahs. It's fine. But you also need lomdas, and lomdas and your didactic mitzvahs is not a substitute for lomdas. So, however, the Rav is such a deeply pious and religious personality that to me, as I look back, I see above all the Rav as a tremendous religious personality. Not just as the great Goy and the fantastic lomdas. Because the two don't necessarily go together. But in the Rav I had this unique combination of a tremendous, original, creative, religious personality who at the same time was this master of so many fields. That's, of course, especially Solomon's. Now, this, I don't want you to think that because of the said that he was not makbid a medaktiv mitzvah. As a matter of fact, sometimes to an extreme. Anyone of you ever wrote a pusbel? How long should it take to write a pusbel? Give me some suggestion. How long do you think it takes to write a pusbel? A shtar pusbel? Huh? You're very makbid, you're very brisk. Most people can do it in 5 minutes. I once wrote a prusbel together with the Rosh Hashanah with Rocha, and it took close to 2 hours. Because in brisk, it's just, der Starr sorgt. You know, in Hilchus Storrs, they're so makbid. They're makbid, for example. I came to New York and I found out that people would. Rishi Shivas, etc., would be Mesada Kedushin, when between Mincha and Ma'arev, between Bein HaShemoshas, and they would have the Kabbalah, the Chasima Sashtar, the Ksuva before, and then the wedding was the next day. The Rav refused. For the Rav, this was no good. The Shtar says, this is the wedding. You have to do it on that day.
Even Meucher.
I said, my Mishnah Meucher. No, he doesn't want Mishnah Meucher. No, because he felt that this tremendous Shtarzot and the way he was marked it. I must have I've learned from him a little bit, and I found out as an average, every Ksuvah that I write, used to write, took me meant about cost me a fortune. I wrote about 4 or 5 ksuvas, Tanda ksuvah, because the Rav taught me that you know, nowadays most people what you do is to put in lines in between, etc. Now I had to make sure that every line is proper, etc., etc., and you fill it out, you make a long resh here and a long kuf here, etc., etc., because the Rav was so makpid that the shtar is properly written. And if you had to make a correction and you arrive at the end, Bishur Azul or so on, so Machisi, etc., because after Mkomo, etc., etc., you know. The Rav was very makpid for these things. And the Rav did not like a good many kulas. Now, but another thing is, when the Rav was involved in not merely abiding by technicalities. The Rav did not like certain heterim. For example, the Rav was extremely hesitant about, let's say, giving a shtar mechira. One of the biggest supporters of the Rav, financially, of the Maimonides, his school, asked him to write him a shtar mechira so that he had a very big factory, that he could have the factory operate on Shabbos. The Rav refused. I know another Gadol B'Yisrael, the one I just named, gave subsequently Ishtar Mechira. Gadol B'Yisrael was probably regarded as much more frum than the Rav. So, as the Rav, I refused. He said, look, if I give this man Ishtar Mechira, what will it mean? He obviously can get Jewish help. Because how can he hire a Jew? If the place is open on Shabbos, he can hire a Jew. Now where should people or Jews who want to be Shomer Shabbos find employment? If I give the religious Jew the option to keep his business open. So he felt no. He wouldn't guide Shtar Mechira. I'll give you another illustration. The Rav refused to sign any Hetamei Rabbonim. Why not? The Rav said, if the shoe would be in the other foot, if the woman would need a Hetamei Rabbonim, she couldn't get it. If that's why he doesn't want to do it for man either. He had this great sensitivity to the needs of women. Now, of course, that's one of the reasons why he pioneered the study of Gemara with girls. I remember my first experience, the first time I came to his home in Boston. I tell you exactly when. Erev, give away my age. It was Erev Shabbos Parshas Pinchas in 1944. I lived that time in Roxbury. I wouldn't ask advice you to come today to Roxbury because Bikuch Nefesh. He lived in Roxbury and I came in by train. This was my trial for my first position in Boston. Roshir was kind enough to refer to the fact that he once came to my shul. So I had to try out for the job. So I come into the house of the Rav. As I enter the door, I hear the Rav saying to his daughter Atara, the question you just raised is found in the Shita Mikubetzes. But to me it was a revelation. A shiva teaches a girl in such a way that they she asks a kasha which is found in the Shita Mikubetzes. And then I began to realize. Then I found out that he, in my mom's day school, he also had girls learn Gemara. And I found out later he felt why. Because he felt it was so difficult nowadays to raise a generation of observant Jews because you have no idea what Orthodox Judaism was in those years. You see, Baruch Hashem had been spoiled. I still saw parts of that Orthodox world where I remember I had a shul called Chayodah, and once before Yom Kippur before Sukkot, to learn Chayei Adam, Hilchos Sukkot. So an old Jew came over to me and said, in America, learn from this nicht. In America, you don't learn to say Hilchos Sukkot. So why not? People don't have Sukkot. You couldn't find a Sukkot. Yes, the shul had a sukkah. Nobody had a sukkah, we speak of. You have no idea what the standards of Yahadus were those years. Now, and day schools were not popular those years. It was a tremendous undertaking of the law to start a day school in Boston. How many students could he get? Because it was a very rare phenomenon. You see, thank God we have lived through a revolution. I remember at the days when people used to say, what's the difference between conservative and reform rabbi? Oh, no, but what's the difference between reform Jew, conservative Jew, and an Orthodox Jew? Why, they say, when you make under $10,000, you're Orthodox. Until $20,000, you're conservative. Above $20,000, you become reform. Why does you have to translate it? We went through an inflationary period, but so multiply it by two or by three. That was the difference. We dealt in the Orthodox community with extremely poor Jews. I remember once had a small a building campaign to provide a youth center. The biggest contribution I got in my shul that time was $100. And this was with personal visits. So it was a poor community. And people were struggling to make a living. I hate to tell you, but they paid me when I started at Rabbonus. I got paid less than a taxi driver makes for me. So we have no idea what the struggle was. So I'll give you a personal illustration. When we first moved to Toronto, I asked my children why we don't eat rice on Pesach. So the answer I got was, because it's not near the end of the month. You can appreciate that. You see, that was the Orthodox community, right? Was poverty stricken, and we had to. So I remember when I came to Toronto, and which was a wealthier community, and when I tried to persuaded my sister to sever the ties with the conservative movement, because they were part of the membership, the sisterhood of conservative organizations, and so one of the women came to him, but why did you have to do that? But why did I have to do that? It's an Orthodox synagogue. Ah, since when it's an Orthodox synagogue, look at your Balbatim. Look at the people. Most of them are not observed. So I said, maybe so, but I tell you, at least the synagogue officially is Orthodox. And the best proof is that when they needed to elect a rabbi, they elected me as an Orthodox rabbi. So it shows it's an Orthodox synagogue. So the answer was, you're still Orthodox. You'll see the light like your predecessor did. Now, predecessor went to a conservative synagogue. It was considered, Orthodox was considered being on its last leg. It's easy to ridicule even the rabbis of that generation, etc. But people have to only understand what we had to deal with. We had to deal with people who were nominally Orthodox. I remember we once published in Tradition an essay called "The Non-Observant Orthodox Jew." I was saying the people consider themselves Orthodox. Even though they were not observant, it meant, or as somebody once put it, the shul, which I think it was, yes, Berlin, the famous writer. Pardon? Not Irving. No. I forgot. He wrote the two kinds of liberty: the Hedgehog and the Fox. Isaiah Berlin. That's Isaiah Berlin. So he was an agnostic and all that, but he said, he attended, I think, on Yom Kippur, and he said, the synagogue, which I usually don't attend, is the Orthodox synagogue. Now that was, remember yet the days? I had many, many members in the shul would come only five times a year. The Shana, Yom Kippur, and only in the morning, of course. Yom Kippur, they came for Kol Nidre, and, excuse me, I made a mistake, six times a year, and for Yisko. I know we had to, for Yisko, to run extra services, because there's such an overflow crowd. Today, I come to a shul, so you come for Yisko, the shul is emptier than usual, because people walk out. But you have to realize there was a time when I came to Boston. I asked my president, I was young, inexperienced, asked my president, what's going to be with this? You have only a few old people here left, or what's going to be? So I said, don't worry. You say, no, what it's here, me kablin day me day, and omrim kaddish. But all some people say kaddish. You know. Didn't realize that it would be another generation that don't even need kaddish. And I can tell you, when I came first to New York and had Levayas and asked the people where they're going to observe Shiva, etc., etc., with the Kaddish, we don't need that. Because that generation, which has both very tenuous ties to Yiddishkeit, a sentimental tie that would come to show, that is gone. Those years, that was still, in some respect, the mainstay of many Orthodox synagogues. Orthodox synagogues had to close down if they wouldn't have these members. So I just want you to understand the difference in the whole climate. As a matter of fact, I still remember when I first came to Boston and I was Menachem Ogel someplace, and then a woman said to me, it's nice now with the young rabbis. So I said, you know, I would like to get a little older yet too. She said, I don't mean that. What do you mean? As long as you don't have beard. So I said, I tell you, I beg to differ. Those years had blonde hair. It wasn't always white. I said, I don't like blonde beards. I wish I had black beard, had black hair, so I could grow a black beard. I don't mean that either. So what do you mean? As long as they're not Orthodox. So I said, I'm afraid to tell you, I'm Orthodox. So I don't remember her reply. But that was the consensus. You see that the rumor went around that my shul went conservative because I came, you know. Nowadays, if I come to Boston, probably all conservative people all say I'm conservative. But those years, it was different. So, that was the impression, and Orthodox was just a. It looked like the last of the Mohegans. So, and the Rav had to instill in us pride in Orthodoxy. And he always told us, we're going to win the battle only by two things. One is in scholarship, lumdas, and the other thing is ethical propriety. And the Rav was extremely careful about ethical propriety. To him, it was very, very wrong to do anything which in the slightest would reflect upon the propriety of what we as Orthodox Jews do. I remember how incensed he was. He was a tremendous lover of Israel and the state of Israel. He was very much interested. But you know, you remember the Lebanese war, the war in Lebanon, and there were the massacres in Sabra and Shatila, and the Rav at that time insisted that unless the Migdal who demand a government investigation of the government. He would resign publicly from his job because he felt that was an ethical lapse, and you had to go to the roots of it. Now, that was the Bostakov, because for the Rov, this was a tremendous challenge. That I can assure you, without the pressure of the Rov, the Migdal would never have voted for an inquiry commission. The Rov put on this pressure, and for the Rov, everything had to be proper, even if it came, when it came to the interest of the State of Israel. Naturally, there's a lot of misunderstanding about the Rov's position. For example, the Rov was the only one who refused to sign the ban against synagogue council, membership of synagogue council, membership of the Board of Rabbis. Why? New York Board of Rabbis. Why was it? Because the Rov felt that these were established organizations, and at this particular moment in Jewish history, we need the unity. The Katchila, he would never have voted. As a matter of fact, in Boston, as the Rosh Yeshiva will remember, there was an associate synagogue, and the Rov did not belong to it. And we had a rabbinical organization, a local rabbinical organization, which had absolutely nothing to do with associate synagogues. And there would have been certain advantages belonging. And to the associate synagogues, you had many rabbonim who belonged, especially old-time rabbonim. However, we did not belong because of the Rov. We're terribly opposed to that. So why all of a sudden, if in Boston he's against the associate synagogues and does not want us to become members of the associate synagogue, why in New York, yes? He felt, since this was already an established precedent, and now, by removing ourselves, we would create more disunity in the Jewish community than it was needed. Now, the Rov was no great lover of reform or conservative Judaism. You know, the Rov once published issued a statement that it is better not to hear shofar than to hear shofar in a conservative synagogue. The Rov, as a matter of fact, interesting, when there was a reform rabbi in Boston, the name of Joshua Locke Liebman, who was a very popular man. he was elected to become the rabbi of Temple Emmanuel in New York, but he declined it, and the governor at that time in Massachusetts said he's so glad that he remains in Boston. Now, when he died, he was the darling of the general community. When he died, all the public schools closed for his funeral. The Rov gave strict orders that his day schools would be open. Because he said, if we have to close down, if I have to close down the school because of the former rabbi dies, I might as well close down the shul altogether, the school altogether. So the Rov certainly was not. But at the same time, the Rov always used tact. And the Rov did not want to embarrass people. I remember I once had a wedding of a balbos. The Rov was Masada Kiddushin. And there was a conservative rabbi from Savannah, Georgia, who came up for the wedding. So the Rov asked him to give the wedding address, which in the public mind of those years, that was the main feature of the wedding. You know, they looked upon this as the most important part of the wedding ceremony. So I asked the Rebbe, how come you give it to a conservative rabbi? So he said to me, this is an individual who came up from Savannah, Georgia for the wedding. Am I going to embarrass him? And the Rov had such sensitivity. There was a very interesting person, I don't want to mention his name, who started out as a reform rabbi, and then he became a conservative rabbi. And he had a pulpit in Boston, near Boston. Became close to the Rov. So one day asked the Rov, do you think I have to give up my my position as rabbi of this synagogue. This is considered a synagogue. Mother Wolf replied, when you're ready to do that, you won't ask me the question. Because the Wolf did not feel like dictating to people. And he felt, how could he tell an individual to give up his livelihood and all that? So he said, when you're ready, you won't ask the question. And Kachat, he found himself in an academic position, etc. But I just show you this in terms of seeing how the Rav could perhaps be misinterpreted at the time, because for the Rav, nothing was so crystal clear. The Rav always used to say, I don't see in black and white, but I see in grays. And that is a big mileage. You see, the Rav often quoted the Meisim, you know the in Pirkei Avos, Ritas of Yochanan ben Zakkai, before his Petira, was terribly worried. So I asked, why was Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai so worried? It was worried. I don't know which way we'll go. We'll go into Gan Eden or Chas Hashem to the Gehenna. So why Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai, of all people, so worried? The Talmidim came and asked him. So he said, Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai once had to make a very difficult decision. Remember the Gemara in Gittin? Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai stood before Vespasian, and he asked, before Vespasian, and he asked him, and Vespasian said to him, because you said the right thing, etc., etc., because when he was talking to him, a message came from Rome that he was elected emperor, etc., etc. So he said, make one wish and I request it. So what Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai said, Ten li yavne v'chachomeh. Rabbi Kiva said about him, Meshiv chachomeh mocha, right? Meshiv chachomeh mocha. Chachomeh make their mistakes too. Because why didn't he ask for Yerushalayim? If he asked for Yerushalayim, he would have a Beis Hamikdash, he would have some heaven, he would have everything the way it should be. Okay, a little town, yavne v'chachomeh, I'll give you. But the price of the war, Yerushalayim wouldn't give you, right? In the basis. So he went through the life not knowing did he do the right thing. So said that is the great disadvantage of a people who is moderate, who sees different perspectives. The people who see black and white, extremists. Extremism is much easier. When you have a middle road, and you realize there are different forces impinging upon you and different considerations, it's not so easy. And so, matter of fact, I said, but this is the middle of the Kodesh Baruch Hu. Remember, Rambam speaks of Decha Benoni in Hilchos Deos. What's that? So most people say that Decha Benoni, you read the literature, Decha Benoni, this is sort of a compromise. A compromise between extremes, and that was what you would call a Balbatish approach. Don't go too far one way or the other, and politically the middle road is always the best. Everybody wants to be in the middle, because the extremists will never win elections. The elections are usually won by people who manage to occupy the center, right? So he says, so in the Rambam says that Decha Benoni, it seems like very practical, don't go all over, be an all around man and don't be extremist in one form or another. He says no, there is the Midah HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The Midah HaKadosh Baruch Hu is just like the Ben Shalom according to Kabbalah. How did the Ben Shalom bring about the Kriyas HaOlam? Chesed and Givurah. And Chesed and Givurah combined to Tiferes. In other words, you have to blend. You have to combine two things. There's Midas Adin, Midas Rachman, right? So therefore, life especially is not so easy. You need the Midas Rachman. And that is why, for example, he also spoke about the importance of the personality. Once gave a drasha and said, Weist is the Perkinian Torah, the so-called sixth Perkinian Avos, begin with Baruch Shebocha Bahem Ud Mishnosa. What's important to us? The Bahem? Mishnosa. Why is it Baruch Shebocha Bahem Ud Mishnosa? So it says, before you can even question the meaning of the Mishnah, you have to know the Bohem, the personality. You cannot be a, you're a lumpen by the cow. You cannot be a lumpen in the Bikurus. You cannot be a lumpen in the Rosha. Yes, you can be a professor of mathematics or biology or chemistry and be a scoundrel. That's the one thing, doesn't affect the other. But you can't be a godly Yisrael and be a scoundrel. With all the brilliance, all the intellectual brilliance, you are not considered a gadol unless you have also the necessary midos. So therefore, Baruch Shebocha Bohem of Mishnosom. Because once we can trust the Bohem, then we can be guided by the Mishnah as well. But he felt that it was terribly important that we have this thing. I'll give you one incident that shows you the ability of the Rav to impress people who are not B'nai Torah. I tell you how impresses even Goyim. I once visited the Rav. Unfortunately, I have no eyewitness. I'm the only one who knows it. And people can deny it. But you don't have to trust me. I visited in the Massachusetts General Hospital. And I came in to see the Rav after an operation. And as I entered the room, there's a goyish intern who says to the Rav, thanks him profusely what he'd done for him. So I was there in amazement. What could an old man do for a young Irish doctor? So after he left, I asked the Rav, Rebbe, what's this? What's going on here? But why didn't he thank you? So he told me, this is a Catholic doctor who had lost his faith in Catholicism. So I persuaded him to go back to the church because if he has religion in him, he'd be a better doctor. And this, he went back to the church and he thanked the Yeshiver for helping him become a goy. A frum goy. Now, of course, it's not so surprising because actually you find this, heard later on a similar story about the Chutz Chaim, not quite the same, but the Chutz Chaim once engaged a balagola, a coachman, to drive him someplace. Those days didn't have cars, and horses. And he refused to go with them. I said, why did you go with him? He said, I noticed he passed by a crucifix and he didn't make the sign of the cross, and therefore I believe I can't trust him. And so you see that even among some Gedolei Yisrael, there was a feeling that a goy who has some religion is better than a goy without any religion. what I'd like you to remember about the Rav is that the Rav was frequently misunderstood because he was such a multifaceted personality, and people saw in the Rav basically what they wanted to see. I once spoke about the Rav, and I used the pasuk from the saying in Amin Smiros. Just about the Rebbeinu Shlom say, "Him shiluchu b'ref esreinos, v'inchu echot b'chol din yonos." I said about the Rav, people seen the Rav different people, and the Rav only disclosed to each individual something different. But the Rav had a tremendous capacity to respond to the needs of each individual. I remember once I asked the Rav, I was that time active in synagogue council, and I wanted to get through a resolution. I was opposed to the Vietnam War. I wanted to get a resolution through that we want also the right for Jewish soldiers to say they do not want to serve in the war because of religious grounds, because we felt that this particular war was immoral. Peter said to Mary, trying to do the Rav is against it. So I went to the Rav and asked the Rav, what is it about? So he said, he doesn't believe that an individual has the right to demand exemption from military service on matters of personal conscience, because you have to consider first the communal needs. I said, Rebbe, but that's not the question. You see, for example, the Quakers have the same right, because the Quakers are opposed to all wars, and since they're opposed to all wars, Quakers could be exempted from military service. So I said, why should Jews who feel that this war in Vietnam is immoral be less privileged to be excused from the army than the Quaker is opposed to all wars? The fact that I would believe that their war against Hitler would be a good war, and the war against Vietnam I wouldn't want to fight in? So the Lord, he said, you're right. Now, it depends very much how you would ask the Lord a question. The Lord would respond differently to different people, because I used to say the art is to know how to ask the question, or the art is how to ask the shaila. If you want a heter, you may make sure you know how to formulate the shaila properly. But that was the rough. So I think I spoke enough. If there are any questions, I'd be glad to answer a few questions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was aware that Ralph knew many secular fields. He was somewhat fluent in them. I was curious if he ever discussed whether his position was just as a link to the secular world, or was he just genuinely interested in those fields?
He was actively genuinely interested in these fields. He encouraged Tamidin to study secular fields. Of course, he also needs, for example, I remember asking questions, some question about electricity. So the Rav said, how can you pass him the Shaila if you don't know the nature of electricity? I'm not sure, is electricity explained by the quantum theory, or is the electricity by the wave theory, right? So if you have doubts about, now of course, he poked fun, so you know, this one. He tells the story about when Gottlieb Yisrael had a shaila about electricity. So he called in an electrician. So the electrician told him there are two wires, and the two wires, there's one wire, and they're positive, negative, etc., etc. And he gave an explanation, and the Rav didn't understand it. Now, I remember there was now a particular Rav who asked this particular question. So the fellow said, I made a mistake. There are two wires. Oh, now I understand. I understand. The Rav used this marshal very often, and people had a question, or a conceptual question on a svara, and people said, bring another maimer where you find the same thing, another halacha, the same thing. So we have two wires, it's better. We don't understand it. You don't understand it. No explanation. You find it elsewhere too. Yeah.
You mentioned that the Rav was learning Gemara because
he felt that the basic influence on children is the mother. And if the mother is not aware of halacha in a deeper sense, he felt it was very difficult for her to have the kind of attitude to halacha that she could really influence her children. And therefore he felt that it was under contemporary conditions necessary to teach girls Gemara. Because if they wouldn't have the Gemara, he would feel that they would not really be prepared to understand halacha sufficiently so that they really could influence their children. And I must confess, in my own personal experience, I've seen a good many families where the mother was religious and the father was not religious, and the children turned out religious. And then I saw the opposite, with the father being religious, the mother not religious, the children usually didn't turn out religious.
So Rav had an insight into the psychology and understood life. Yeah.
What about learning Gemara in the same classes?
Rav did it in Boston because he felt he had to.
I heard from someone that the reason he did that was that there wasn't enough funding.
That's right.
So, I mean, it was for him not a case of Yehori Gualiava. He probably would have preferred to have separate classes, but I don't think it's a question just of Gemara, you know. I don't think he looked upon co-education as an ideal, but he didn't have enough students, there was not enough funding for that, so he felt to have a viable school, he had to have the same Gemara. But he could have sacrificed Gemara, but he didn't want girls not to learn Gemara because he thought it was important to them to know Gemara.
By the time, by like 70s or 80s, when the school grew a great deal, it could be about the school not there.
I don't know. Obviously, he did not feel I think they had more intensive classes in Gemara for boys. No, that's a separate issue. Now, whether the study of, he felt that the study of Gemara was vital for girls in the present situation.
I can say I would corroborate what Rabbi Wurzburg is saying, because I also had, I don't want to repeat exactly what the specific Shiloh was, but I spoke to Rav also about the question of, you know, the boys and girls together in a school, and he indicated what Wurzburger said, that the ideal situation is certainly that they're apart. And, I mean, that's definitely what it was.
But he didn't think it was so important that he wouldn't... I mean, there's a question of priorities. Pardon? Yeah, there are many, many factors.
It seems to be over the past maybe 20 years, there has been expanded into a community, especially Orthodox, towards the more what they call from. Did the Rav have any opinion about what was going on?
Well, the Rav hadn't, of course, he knew what was going on. And, he liked certain film manifestations, others he didn't like. You know, as I said to you, that he, for example, indicated to me that he said the trouble nowadays is they have text without a tradition. In fact, so if you want to know more about that, there's a famous article by Chaim Soloveitchik in Tradition. Chaim Soloveitchik wrote about it in great length. Not just what the Rav said, you know, Chaim Soloveitchik is a great scholar. But I would say this was essentially the Rav's position. You have to also take into account that many of the Rav's rulings are predicated on the fact that this was a very unusual kind of situation. The Rav said we have today shilas, which are so difficult to paskin. As a matter of fact, I remember once a convention of the Rabbinical Council where he said, what are you going to do if, for example, you have a mixed pews congregation? And if you don't allow a man from the yeshiva to occupy this position, what will happen is that no one will go from this community to yeshivas, and there won't be a mikra, and there won't be proper kashrus. On the other hand, you have to how can you tell a person to go to a shul which is not halakha? So he said that these are unusual times, and you have to weigh, and you cannot give fixed formulas for that.
When the during the time when the Rav was speaking out publicly, the Mashiach fever was going on then too?
No, but the Rav was very ill. The Rav would never engage in, I once wrote about it in the Rav's position on these issues, and I pointed out that the Rav, while he was not one word, we never hear from the Rav the concept of any kind of messianic overtones. For Medina Yisrael was tremendously important, because he felt that without Medina Yisrael at this particular stage, the Yahadis would have perished, because people would simply feel after the Holocaust there would not have been a Medina Yisrael, that it would be extremely difficult to have any kind of Yiddishkeit in America, especially because the people would simply try to get away from Yiddishkeit completely. But you never mentioned anything about messianic or pre-messianic or Eurasian symbols or saying all that. Did not play a role in the law.
At that time, the Lubavitch didn't put forward that idea?
No. I can... the Rav had a weak spot for Lubavitch. I once went to the Rav in the early 40s, not to be present, but the but the one who the last Rebbe who was admitted to have died. I don't want to curve the Rav. And this Mashiach, the Rebbe indicated, the Rav indicated how much he owes to a Rebbe. His ordained was a Lubavitcher Chassid. And the Rav once told me that he regards the Baal HaTanya as one of the most original and creative Jewish philosophers. And I saw the Rav many times with the Likud HaTorah, especially on the Yom Tov, etc. The Rav had a daily of regard for that. He incorporated this all. The Rav was not... People for a long time had thought of the Rav only as an Ish Halacha, which was due to the fact that the first major publication which the Rav gave, which was on standard here, was Ish Halacha. People didn't know that at the same time already was written an Ish Hadat of religion, but the Rav was too that out of it. I know it because the editor at that time who was had told me about it, and the Rav was extremely reluctant always to publish. As a matter of fact, the first time I got everything from him to publish, I used a little bit of psychology. I went to the Rav and I said to him, Rabbi, I understand you're going to speak at the status of Rabbanim about a convention about Christian-Jewish relationships. Because at that time there was an attempt made to be ecumenical kind of stuff. So Rav spoke to him. So I said, Rabbi, if you don't want your views known, it's your business. But if you want your views known in the general Jewish world, then the proper medium is not the Morgen Journal. It's not the Fichavotcha, right? Write for respected publication, not the Fichavotcha. The Morgen is not the Fichavotcha. Said, you're right. I give it to you for tradition. Okay. I was very happy, I really was not concerned to get it so much for tradition. I just wanted him to have it in a respectable publication. So, subsequently, he spoke at the convention and said, this time my talk is differently because he arranged me to have it published in tradition. So I felt good. I was going to get it from him. 1 week passed, 2 weeks passed, 3 weeks passed, 4 weeks passed, I didn't get it. Finally, I called the law firm and I said, I finally got it from him. And he said to me, now you can stop worrying. He said, let me know. This is only the manuscript. And after the manuscript comes the galley proofs. And after the galley proofs come the page proofs. But after you get the page proofs, I'm going to disconnect my telephone so you won't be able to tell me you don't publish. Because he was very, very reluctant to publish. I remember that particular thing with the Catholic Church. He had a page, a phrase which he said, many among the Catholic Church, which have many friends and enemies, enemies and friends, he wanted to change to many friends and many enemies. I couldn't argue with him. It cost us a lot of money, you know, when you changed it in page rules, because, that was the goal. How didactic he was. So the famous article, I'm a lonely man of faith. I got, there are a few things which I felt from an editor's point of view should be changed. So I started to make this. My wife said to me, fool's tread, the angels fear the tread. So I didn't, but I wrote on a sheet some of the suggested changes. And I gave them to Aaron Lichtenstein, who was correcting the manuscript for page proofs. So there was one phrase, another midrashic explanation, interpretation. There was a comma in between another and midrashic. So I got the page, the proofs back, and then I wanted to visit Professor Tversky's son-in-law. I didn't know exactly where, so Aaron Lichtenstein offered to guide me there, to go with my car there, and when I was there, he took Professor Tversky took Lichtenstein back to the Rolf's house. So in between, I had nothing to do, so I looked over the proofs, and I see that the comma still was standing, and it bothered me. It didn't look aesthetic, another comma mythologic. So when Professor Tversky came back, I said to him, tell me, you think I can delete this comma without permission? He said, go ahead. What's his answer? No. I see Professor Tversky again on Sunday. This was Erev Shabbos, was this. He was in Onset that time, so I didn't see him on Sunday again. So he said to me, you know, we had a discussion of half an hour's length about whether this comma was properly placed or not. So I lost my temper and I said, to tell a story about Chaim Voloshin. Chaim Voloshin once wrote a letter, and after he finished the letter and sent it away to a messenger, he quickly got someone else to go after the messenger and called it back. So he said, why did he call him back? The people noticed he copied that letter. There was one little change. The letter was addressed to his daughter Chassia, which he had written with a hey, and he made an aleph out of it. So he said, the reason I changed it was, maybe at some future time to be get needed for a woman named Chassia. And if they see I wrote Chassia with an aleph, they may think it's the proper way, it should be written an aleph. So I was afraid to set the wrong precedent, etc., etc. So I said, I don't know how the Rav would be remembered in history. Where's the big Gadol Hador, as the big Manhig, as the great philosopher, as the great London, as whatever you want. But I know one thing. It won't be done as it wouldn't be Soloveitchik and American grammar. But for him, it was so important. Somebody told me that a little message he wrote for the journal of his school, you know, for the art journal for the school, a little message, you know, he insisted on seeing it again and again, made changes, etc., etc. Because there's a Chazaka Shiotzudovich Eino Mesukah. I'm so afraid of the proper word. I have my own bitter experience with that, because I once submitted an article to Tradition before I was editor. My lamb was the editor at that time, and I got a very enthusiastic note from that lamb. 3 weeks later, I get a note, it's rejected. A little surprise. So asked Professor Fox of him, Vrocha, what happened? So he told me, Rav objected. Rav vetoed. So I decided to rewrite the article, tone it down a little bit, and remove some of the illustrations I heard from the Rav myself. And I sent it to the Rav for his approval, so I could submit it or not. Didn't hear from him, so finally it was before my first trip to Israel, and I figured in case I get shut down over the Atlantic, hope to get have some legacy. You know, young have all kinds of ambitions. And I thought it was a good article. So the Rav said, don't publish it. Ask him why. What's wrong with it? Nothing. Why shouldn't I publish it? Because people will say you write like a conservative rabbi. In other words, there was nothing wrong with the article, but he's afraid of the misinterpretation that would be given. Now, the Rav is extremely careful, and I tell you, I have dealt with him in writings, etc. And he made so many corrections, sometimes I used to say facetiously, the more he edits it, the worse the article becomes. Because whatever was a little bit controversial, he used to remove. Because the Rav is afraid of misinterpretation. But the Rav was extremely careful, not only for himself, but also for his Talmidim. Because he, I guess he had good reason to be so careful. Because as it was, unfortunately, in the yeshiva world, many did not recognize him. Yeah, that's why you find many of his chidushim quoted in his forum as Mipi HaShmur. Mm-hmm. People didn't want to attribute him to Rabbi Yosef there, yeah, but Mipi HaShmur. Which is a great tragedy. Oh. I have
to pick up my mind. Yes, sir. Thank you very much. Gems.
He has no, he's a dangerous person. Yeah, but he has no scruples, no morals. So, insofar as the beliefs in the system itself, it's really like what a Balatasar says. It's like, men are going to send me a damn. So they're not really into the...
They don't analyze it.
They don't really, you know. On the other hand, it's something which restricts them and makes them more ethical.
I guess you have to assess whether the person's going to be...
That's what I'm saying. The Rav had to make a certain judgment. So, you know, he had different, different considerations. He had to weigh different things.
The Rabban said that in the end of the Malachim, right?
Yeah, well, he says that it is. So, right, something came out of it eventually. You know, he had to weigh these things. But the truth of the matter, I mean, you know, it's a different kind of thing. I think what he showed was that the way the Rav thought things over, things were going on in his mind that most people, I mean, just didn't know, had no idea, you know.
Yeah,
he made by gray he meant different considerations.
He said it, like Rabbi Yochanan.
Right.
Battling between
this way
his mind was always.
Yeah, Chacham sees a different world than.
Yeah, he said the Baal HaBas is the one that thinks like. Yeah, oh, yeah, like you gotta go like in the middle, you know.
What about the issue of not being able to prove Torah?
That's an interesting thing because I guess he felt. I mean, it was very interesting in that because the point is that what he felt was that if a person is true, that if a person is a person that goes to college, unfortunately, he came to New York and he ended up Garris. But the thing that, the thing is, it's unbelievable. Unbelievable story. But the thing is that those type of people. It's an influential kind of a thing, and you're not going to just write. It's not going to work. It's an indication of a person that has a certain is bent in a certain direction. It's not the logics of the situation. If the guy comes to us and says, "Look, I have a logical question," that's one thing, but it's not a logical question. I felt he just can't. He's not a magic man.
He had to have some experiences in order to change that.
I could show him what Yahadis is. But if a guy's going to adamantly say, "Prove it to me," I mean,
he's not really asking.
He has to bend the emotions. And then the other way.
Really, yeah, he's not right. It's, yeah, the guy's going to take an emotional stance. it's not going to work. And he saw that the this guy has problems.
So friend of mine happened to him in college. He kind of lost a major. He was a very thin guy, and then that was it. Yeah, and like the doc get, and he tried to give him proofs, and he was like, "Yeah, but I got this proof, and I got that proof." And like, it was all like you're working.
Like you said, when there was a person who asked you, like,
in the world are affected by proof? Very few. Very rare individual is going to change his life because of it. Just, people just don't think that way. They may talk like they're interested in proofs, but the fact is they're not.
So didn't you once say maybe that meaning the proof will get you in the door, but it's when you experience like the learning and see the chachma, really see the chachma, that's what will.
I mean, there is such thing as a proof, but the thing is that proof means to the satisfaction of somebody. I mean, it has to be. A person could always run away into different. Person could, I mean, ultimately run away into skepticism. So you can't believe that. I mean, ain't no double self. That's be a seichel yashar. I mean.
He didn't ask that question.
Okay.